producer Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please stay safe.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices for Justice and Radical Healing. From Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. Voices for Justice and Radical Healing is an online speaker series in support of Living Yoga's trauma-informed services. Speakers will explore ways to create healing for individuals, systems, and culture through body-based practices. Again, that's Voices for Justice and Radical Healing from Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the Zoom is David Skolton. Hey, David.
Hey, nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. So why don't you tell our listeners about your teaching background and experience, and also what brought you to teaching?
Well, I mean, I'm probably not the typical path to be a teacher. I meandered around, you know, in my 20s and most of my 30s, actually, you know, deciding if I really wanted to fully participate in the world or not, or whether I wanted to kind of be a bystander. And part of that meandering brought me to Japan, where I ended up teaching in the public schools for about 5 years. The last 3 years were in middle school and elementary school. And it was at that point that I kind of had two things that happened for me. One is that I, through various processes and kind of, you know, inner discoveries, I recognized that I did actually want to participate in the world. And then the second question was, okay, how can I do that in a meaningful way? You know, coming to this realization a little bit later in life. And this teaching experience in Japan made me realize, you know, how much I love kids. I love supporting them. As I started to realize that there was only so much I could do in Japan with a teaching career, I realized I needed to come back to the United States and you know, finish up my education and start my teaching career. So, it was a way that I felt like it could make a difference. And also, you know, at the point of life that I was in, do it, you know, actually manage that transition to, you know, a career path. So it's my sixth year now at PPS. And that's kind of how, that's kind of what brought me here.
And where are you teaching in PPS?
I teach at Abernathy Elementary School. I teach fifth grade, and I've been teaching fifth grade since I arrived there.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Great. Thanks. And what about union involvement? Are you involved in union? And if so, how?
I am. And actually, you know, I was kind of thinking about, you know, why, what's my kind of my history. Some of the work that I did meandering around was in environmental organizing. So I worked in Colorado for Clean Water Action, and I worked in Southern Utah, you know, for a group called Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, defending public lands against, you know, people who want to exploit it. My first 3 years of teaching, I actually waited quite a while to really get involved in the union. And I think that probationary period really scared me. Like I had a family, and I didn't want to put myself too much out there, you know, during that period where, you know, the district has kind of a pretty, you know, wide swath of who they can let go without too much reason. But when my fourth year hit, I felt that kind of reignition of this desire to be active in a way and questioning, you know, what's happening in the work that I do. So at that point, I became a union rep. So I represent Abernathy to the Portland Association of Teachers. I'm the union rep for my school. And then I also, I sit in on the Social Justice and Community Outreach Committee, which is a subcommittee of, you know, of PAT, and, you know, just try to stay active with you know, the various events and I especially am interested in racial justice. So the racial justice events and trainings that are happening throughout the district and the ones that the union offers are interesting to me.
Wow, that's really interesting stuff. And having known you for years, I'm learning a lot of new things about you today. So in terms of where we are now in distance learning, how has that been going for you and your colleagues in your building? And is there anything that's been going well?
Yeah, how it's been going for my colleagues and me. So, I mean, first of all, I want to acknowledge that I'm at a school that has high-performing kids in general. Abernathy is a school that's, you know, with a lot of parent involvement. And I'm also with a group of teachers that has had a lot of cumulative experience. So we've got one on our team who's been there for 25 years, another of our team, she's been there for 10 years. And we were really working together as a team to split up the work. Even with those advantages to our benefit, which I know that a lot of schools and teams don't have, I'm still working, you know, I'm still working a lot. I'm still working 10, 11 hour days. At night, when my kids go to bed, I'm working for a couple hours. I'm getting up really early to make sure I can get those, you know, couple hours between 6 and 8, you know, that are a little bit quieter. And just a lot of time in front of the computer. So it has been taxing. And yet I also recognize that it's been a lot more taxing for other people. I think one thing that's going well is I'm getting to know my kids as individual learners in a different way than I did in when we actually went to school in the brick and mortar school. I mean, I'm seeing their assignments and really looking more carefully at each of their assignments in a way that maybe I didn't in brick and mortar. And so I'm getting a sense of them as learners. I don't feel like I'm getting as much of a sense of them as people, because like it's hard to experience their personalities. Mm-hmm. But I almost wonder, you know, we've been talking about this on our team. We were almost kind of wondering if the personality piece might not even get in the way sometimes of getting to know a learner, because, you know, you naturally like some kids and you naturally, you know, have some other kids that are challenging for you. But this is really more like, okay, I'm looking at their work and seeing what kind of work they do, what kind of effort they put into it. Just seeing that more clearly this year, I think has been kind of a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of concern among educators about the inequities revealed by distance learning. What are some of the issues you've seen, and maybe firsthand or also things that you've heard throughout the district?
Yeah, well, I mean, so firsthand, like, for example, I've got a student this year who speaks English as a second language, and he's even a newcomer to the U.S. in the past year, and he is not keeping up. I mean, and I've set, you know, 15, 20 minutes aside, just one-on-one for him each day. And so he gets ESL services, but, you know, what he would have had in the brick and mortar was a complete immersion into English culture. Mm-hmm. Would be hearing that all the time. I think his language development would be, you know, moving ahead because of that. And so I think services are kind of built with that in mind, but right now he is falling behind. He doesn't have as much support at home. Actually, his dad travels with work, so he's on the road a lot. I see that he's, you know, kind of really disadvantaged at this point. And then I just see there are some students who I have whose parents both work and they're not getting home till 3 or 4. And those kids are just not getting as much done. You know, they don't have someone there to keep them on track. So mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest inequities is the fluctuation of home environments is so dramatic. There's just no way you can expect kids to perform up to their capabilities even. So it's really hard to tell what kids' capabilities are when so much of it is dependent upon, is there someone home to keep them on track? Whereas mm-hmm. at school, the teacher would be there to keep everybody on track as best we could. So that's the main thing that I've been hearing about, or that's the main thing I've been experiencing personally. And then what I've also heard about is kids who are on individual education plans, it's just hard for them to meet their minutes. It's hard for them to get their scheduling with their teachers. And it's hard to be, you can't really do a small group anymore with kids who have higher needs. It needs to almost be one-on-one or one teacher with two students, and they can't do that. So there's a lack of focus. You know, kids aren't able to focus on in the small groups. And then it has a racial element to it too, because we know that that our Black and Brown students are overrepresented in, you know, students who have, who are referred for IEPs. And so they're suffering most in that way.
Mm-hmm. I also heard from a parent who's also an educator, but I have her child in my class, and she was talking about how much students get from talking to each other and processing things, you know, verbally with each other in the class, and all that sort of interaction and ways of rethinking and understanding and getting help. I mean, it's, you know, it goes beyond us and adults, right? And they're missing out on all this, like, you know, peer learning and interaction. It's been a big deficit.
It has a social element and an academic element too, especially for teachers who really do want to step aside and be a facilitator in the classroom. I think if you're a teacher that, you know, has your desks all in a row and you're lecturing to the kids all day and they're spitting back what you're lecturing, then the cost is less. But I think a lot of teachers now are moving into that model of, you know, wanting to facilitate kids to do the learning among themselves. And so, yeah, you're missing out on that. And the social piece too, which is huge for kids to, I mean, like take fifth grade, you know, where they're just starting to kind of, at the end of fifth grade, they're going to be starting like that kind of puberty type, you know, they're going to be entering that stage, and to be able to have those interactions and they're just, yeah. It's hard to quantify that, but it seems like it would be huge.
Yeah.
It reminds me of our students who don't have English as their first language. They're learning English, and you talk about the social aspect and how much of the language that they are learning through that. Yeah. If they're in a home environment where they're speaking another language predominantly, I just wonder how much this is setting them back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. And I want to remind everyone that you can still donate today at kboo.fm/give, or you can also send it in the snail mail, a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. That's the fall membership drive that started in September and is going all the way through October. So please, if you haven't already, we would really appreciate a donation to KBOO. Well, you were talking about inequities, and we invited you on the show to talk about standardized testing in schools. So can you talk about the issue from a broad perspective, talking about testing, I mean, as it relates to inequity and also the attack on public schools and educators' unions?
Yeah, well, you know, the standardized testing has its roots in the 1920s in the eugenics movement, a movement that sought to prove that people with lighter colored skin were more intelligent than people with darker colored skin. So like we did, for example, the SAT. The SAT was first, you know, administered in order to prove that white superiority, that there is this, you know, that the races should be classified based on, you know, on which race you belong to. And like all tests that are designed to show racial inferiority or superiority, it did that. It showed that, if you can see, I kind of have the air quotes going, you know, it showed that. The way that it showed that is that people with darker color skin did more poorly on the test than people with lighter color skin. And so, it was always pitched as, no, this test doesn't measure, your station in life. It measures your actual intelligence in the same way that the, that other standardized tests have always sought to do. So as we move forward in time, we see that, tests like the Oregon State Assessment System that's given at the end of the year, it does the same thing. It shows that African American students and Latinx students do worse on the test. But what it doesn't seek to do is ask why are they doing worse on the test? So I guess, you know, the broad idea about standardized testing, what I always think about is, what's the point of giving the test? We know the results of the test. The results of the test will show that white kids are doing worse, are doing better than brown and black kids. So what's the point of giving it if we know that? That's number one. And number two is kind of asking why are they doing worse? And a lot of teachers now are looking to things like, who are their teachers? Do their teachers look like them is one thing. You know, what's the curriculum about? Is the curriculum European centered? Is it Latinx centered? Is it African centered? You know, where's the things that they're learning? And then also looking at, you know, the disadvantages that affect kids' performance in school that aren't school related. You know, that all this web of systemic racism that we're tied in, you know, that, you know, the economy, healthcare, criminal justice, how kids are disciplined more in school, you know, kids of color are disciplined more in school, even though they commit those offenses at the same rate. And looking at the web that's kind of creating this this system where, you know, kids are bound to under those stresses, not perform as well in a high pressure test.
Yeah, I know sometimes I've heard that saying that the tests basically show you what zip code the students are from.
Yeah, I've read that too. I've read that, you know, that standardized tests are pretty good. You know, you can't tell much about them, but you can tell where you've come from. You can tell what neighborhood you live in. Yeah, that's about all they're good for.
Well, and also that, you know, people can take a class and pay lots of money to get test prep and perform considerably better than the first time they took it, you know.
Yeah, so yeah.
That's an access issue.
Yeah, it's an access issue, right? And like, you know, you can be good at taking tests. These standardized tests, you can get your points up. You can go 20 points up on the SAT just by taking, you know, a simple course, for example. But I think what's interesting is that, like, you mentioned unions and how it affects, you know, unions, and I think, you know, teachers and unions, is that you know, the purported purpose of the test, of any standardized test, is or so it's said by those who are giving it, is to, you know, kind of show academic progress and academic ability, you know, in kind of a wide swath. But what that is also doing is it's taking the power out of the hands of the educator to be able to assess their kids in an individual way. So in the same way that standardized tests have this cookie cutter mentality, like we're going to test all the kids on the same merit, and we're going to pretend that the test is colorblind, individual educators know that each child, we know what their race is, we know their ethnic background, we know what languages, we know about their families. And so we can assess kids in an authentic way to find out what they really do know and what they still need to work on. So the standardized test kind of takes that away, that power away from educators and gives it to a computer, really.
And it also, I mean, just on that same vein, it limits what we're looking at as learning and achievement, right? Or so, I mean, there are so many different ways to learn, and there are so many different ways to express your learning, demonstrate your learning. And yeah, when we narrow like sort of the parameters with which we look at learning, we're kind of rendering invisible all these different ways of being intelligent and expressing yourself and exploring and building knowledge.
Yeah, and you know what you're saying also is reminding me of, like, you know, it's one of the tenets of white supremacy culture is to, you know, value rational knowledge above all other forms of knowledge, right? So, you know, we these tests are measuring our ability to, you know, spit back these rational points to each other. But as you're saying, this artistic intelligence or this kinesthetic intelligence, it isn't, or the ability to tell a story.
Yeah, interpersonal intelligence.
I mean, which has been valued for, you know, the length of our human species until European, you know, culture really took over the world, has now, you know, just been pushed right to the top of, you know, and it, like you said, it excludes other ways of knowing. I totally agree.
Right. And sometimes it's painted as, well, teachers just don't want to be held accountable. That's why they don't want to use these standardized tests for assessing their students. But really what you're saying is far from that. It's just that there are many other ways that you can assess students that are much more accurate and equitable and useful, right?
Right, yeah, and then that honor the whole child, mm-hmm, not just one tiny part of their being.
Right,
mm-hmm, yeah.
And so is there some, you know, dark, sinister plot here that's going on? Why do you think we're really, educators are being pressured to use these tests?
I think it's because politicians get into a field that isn't theirs. I think it's because people with political power are seeking this accountability, as they call it. And so they're kind of getting into, like I said, a field that they really don't know what's best. They think they know what's best for kids. I do. I'm not a big conspiracy theorist. I mean, I kind of trust people with, in large part, having good intentions. But I just think it's misguided. And it's what happens when money and politics and, you know, politicians and government saying, well, if you're going to get this much money, then we want to make sure you're spending it properly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, if white supremacy culture is that embedded in our political system, which I believe it is, and if you look at the racial makeup of our politics, it's hard to just kind of dispute that, then it would make sense that, again, we're going back to this kind of like, how are you going to measure whether the money is being spent right? Well, it's going to be based on this European, you know, this European idea of what knowledge is.
Yeah. You know? I guess I just want to throw out there too that it's not a conspiracy. There's no shortage of evidence that there really is an effort to privatize public schools, just like other public institutions, right? Just like the post office is clearly, there's an effort right now that's quite evident. And testing is, you know, plays a role in that effort to seek to privatize schools. It's a way to, testing is weaponized, right, against schools where the students don't perform well. Well, where are the schools where the students don't perform well on these standardized tests, right? They're predominantly in lower income you know, Black and brown communities. So it's really an attack on public schools. And if you're attacking public schools, then essentially you're attacking the, you know, the educators who are unionized who work in those schools. So it's not a conspiracy. I mean, if you just, all you have to do is connect the pieces together, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And this sort of gets us to your organizing, but we know that just on what we were just talking about, the testing industry is a very lucrative market, right? And you were instrumental in organizing around MAPS testing in PPS. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what MAPS testing is and what concerns educators had with the test?
Yeah, well, I will say I helped get the ball rolling, but I'll tell you, once it got rolling, it didn't take too much to get that thing going downhill. I mean, it was a slight little push by a few of us, and then it rolled. I think the CDL really opened a lot of people's eyes. A comprehensive distance learning really opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that this testing doesn't work here, and then by default, you can kind of see that it doesn't work ever. But so yeah, I mean, we at my school, we were organizing against MAPS last year, and we were kind of all in agreement that we shouldn't even do it in the brick and mortar. It's too much testing in third through fifth. They're double testing in the spring. They're doing MAPS and Oregon State Assessment System. So it's 4 weeks of testing in the spring. You just miss out on instruction.
Wow.
So we kind of had this going, you know, last year, but we didn't move on it. For a lot of reasons that I don't want to get into right now. Just it didn't work. We didn't quite turn the corner on it. But we had that organizing in our school already. And so when we came back together and we suggested that we resist this year, we had teachers on board that were saying, you know, they would be willing to refuse to give the test. Once we organized with a few other schools, so I kind of put something out on Facebook and I noticed that, you know, a few schools had this core of people that wanted to resist, and we drafted a letter to PPS, not saying that we refused to give the test. We worked, you know, and kind of worked a little bit with our union to back down a little bit and just saying that we opposed it. And we also reached out to our parent groups and said, this is something that we're working on. We want to let you know that we're sending this letter to our principals and to the attendant, you know, the superintendent. And this is how we feel about it. And so, like I said, there were a bunch of calls that came through, and we had letters from four schools with 100% participation of teachers at each of those schools. And I think, I don't know, I think that the district actually hadn't looked very closely at MAPS testing, and probably realized pretty quickly when they got the letters that they should have looked more closely at it, because they backed down right away. So, I mean, yeah. So they agreed to not give the test for the fall term.
So we only have a few minutes left, like maybe two. I guess I'm wondering what's next in terms of this, because it sounds like the district is halting this temporarily.
Yeah.
You guys want it to be...
Yeah. Well, okay. As part of my answer, I just want to state the three main reasons that we objected to the test.
Yes, okay. Please.
The first is that it eats up a lot of instructional time. We miss time with our kids. We can't teach them as much. It would probably take 2 or 3 weeks to get through the test. Small groups missed for 2 or 3 weeks. The data is not reliable because, in distance learning, it's not reliable because there's nobody there to proctor the test at home. The kids could be looking at, have another tab open on the computer and getting the answers. I mean, it's that absurd. And the third is that it's a racist test, meaning that it will show this, you know, quote unquote gap between kids of color and white kids, which a colleague of mine, you know, Chris Reiser, he wrote that paragraph on our letter. He knows that back and forth. So I suggest him as a guest sometimes, if you want to talk about, you know, really talk up that angle. But just that's really not, that's really a gap, meaning that's a funding gap. You know, it's kids have just not been afforded the same opportunity. So these three things, so if you look at these three things, they also take place in the brick and mortar school. When we go back to school, it's still going to be lost instruction time. It's still going to be, the data is going to be unreliable. But now the effects won't be the proctoring situation, it will be all the stresses that the kids have at home that they bring into school. Mm-hmm. And also their motivation to take a test that they know doesn't mean anything to them. You know, and then the racism piece obviously doesn't go either. So yeah, I mean, looking forward, it's, you know, really having a conversation about standardized testing and, you know, I think a lot of teachers might not be on board for getting rid of MAPS completely, but does it need to be given 3 times a year? You know, is it a good benchmark assessment? Do we need to give the standardized test 3 times a year? And interestingly, if I have just another moment, PPS, in part of their letter in backing down on MAPS testing, said, we don't need to give MAPS in the spring because it's such a similar test in the Oregon statewide assessment system that we don't need to double up. We've been doing this for 4 or 5 years. We've been doubling up, and it's been brutal for kids. And we've let the district know it's been brutal for kids. So I guess we wake up slowly. I'm waking up slowly too. So,
well, David, I really want to thank you for joining us on KBOO and
having this conversation. David.
Yeah, it's been really great. And I'd like to thank Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, audience, for tuning in. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock p.m. to catch another Labor Radio show.
This is KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hi, this is Emma with Fizzy.